Today we have dietitian Tracy Brown as a guest to discuss Principle 7, Cope with Your Emotions Without Using Food. Tracy is a dietitian who specializes in eating disorders and utilizes somatic nutrition therapy as an approach. In our conversation today, Tracy shares some of her own journey to food freedom and becoming a dietitian, why simply knowing the facts about nutrition doesn't always create change, the neurobiology of trauma, techniques to help ground yourself towards safety, and so much more. I learned so much from this talk with Tracy and found myself also taking notes to come back to and learn on my own time. As a side note, in the past I've read off journal prompts for each of the principles, but I think it will be easier if you can just go ahead and read the prompts yourself afterwards, since if you're like me, when you hear prompts and things like that in audio, it's easy to forget them or you have to repeat them a zillion times to remember what they are. So go ahead and go to my website and you'll find each of the prompts with their associated episode, and that's going to be at spillingthebeansnutrition.com/podcast. Well, today, as I already mentioned, we have Tracy with us to talk to us a little bit about Principle 7, which is cope with your feelings without using food. So welcome to the podcast today, Tracy.
Oh, Amanda, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here, and I hope everybody enjoys this and gets what they need today.
Yeah, well, before we dive into everything, I want you just to kind of preface our conversation by telling my listeners a little bit about yourself and your practice.
Sure. So like I said, my name's Tracy. I've been a dietitian since 2004. I do have my own recovery story as well. And I was super fortunate to honestly hook up with a non-diet dietitian before they actually kind of had that name and existed back in like 1996, 97. And it wouldn't have been like an intuitive eating. She wouldn't have labeled herself that way. She simply was like, hey, look, you got into this mess somewhat by trying to make food be everything for you. And now we need to have food habits proper place and learn how to be in right relationship with food. So basically she taught me eat the food and learn how to trust yourself. So my practice kind of has always revolved around that. And since 2006, I've been a non-diet dietitian. After just one or two, actually just a couple years of being a dialysis dietitian, I knew that I would transition from just basically a dietitian who has a job into my own practice and work. And I knew immediately that going from like becoming a recovered person into becoming a dietitian. Now I became a dietitian because I thought all dietitians were like the dietitian I had. I had no idea that when I went to school that I would actually be faced with almost becoming a glorified diet pusher. And I'm like, what am I going to do? Because I can't teach the things that I'm unlearning to have a full thriving life. And so I knew immediately as a dietitian, I couldn't do basically glorified diet counseling for people. And so as soon as I could get out of school, get that license, get my first job, I started training to be an eating disorder dietitian. And so that's been going on since the early 2000s. And yeah, so my practice has been weight inclusive and fat positive, and also really worked really hard to have it be as client co-piloting with me as possible around food, weight, goals, movement, and trauma-informed care.
Well, that's really interesting and not the norm of stories I hear about when people first encounter a dietitian, especially back in the 90s, where I feel like from what I can recall from the 90s, it was very much the era of low fat and like the slim, fast diets of the world. Mm-hmm. So it's actually pretty shocking to hear that you encountered someone, even though they didn't identify as what we now call a non-diet dietitian, but that was the dietitian that you were able to work with.
Well, I think it was born, so I'm from the Midwest, and she, I think, worked a lot with families and children, and she had done some training with Ellen Satter. So I'm from Illinois, Wisconsin's just a state up north, and I think she did training with her way back. And so that she worked a lot with families about how to like just basically feed people normatively. I use that word with air quotes. And so I think that's just the framework she practiced from. And I think that she recognized that I needed to relearn how to eat, and she treated me that way versus like, here's your plan. And she had to work with my resistance, my hesitance, my fear. But honestly, she kind of reparented me more than she talked to me about nutrition. And that's what I needed. So, and I just think that's, I'm 18 years old thinking this is what dietitians do. This is awesome. It's like, it's like counseling, but like very warm and client-centered, and didn't make me feel like the inferior here and listen to me, even though some of my stuff was fear-based and didn't get too lost in the weeds with that, and just work helped me work through it. Yeah, it's not the norm. And I feel very fortunate to this day. And, you know, I may have been doing something totally different if not for her approach.
And that's exactly what I was going to say, is I bet that could have completely changed your career path had you had a different experience. And it could have changed your own relationship with food too. And it could have changed it for the worse had you had a different experience with that dietitian.
Oh, absolutely. No, I didn't, I'll be honest, I was pretty much like, F everyone at that point, and didn't trust anybody. So I really needed someone to be like, hey, I get it that you're afraid and there are some beliefs around food that maybe are serving you in some kind of way. But in the reality is, this is what is happening with your body. And so what you think is happening isn't actually happening, like fear around certain foods. And she really just helped me look at the incongruence of what I was thinking versus the result or realities of on your body with health and what your weight is, and just helped me kind of understand, like gave me lots of choice points, you know, and gave me a lot of authority back around like, how do I want to deal with things? And you could do it this way, but here are the consequences. And you don't have to like that. But I can handle it, basically. Like, whatever you got, let's put that on the table.
Yeah, well, and it sounds similar to a lot of my clients tell me what they need from me sometimes is what they call fact checking. And it sounds similar to what you're describing, is you kind of can come to someone who has that background in the human body and also in nutrition, and you can lay out the facts. And because as we both know, there's so much misinformation out there, and we can kind of help you tie up all those loose ends. And then ultimately you do have your own autonomy over your body, but hopefully you can make a more informed decision as a result of having that knowledge.
Yeah. And certainly that relationship didn't fix the body image issue, and understanding that, you know, in the training that I had gotten 15 years later was, and this will kind of maybe go into our conversation today, is like understanding that our body is the container for a lot of sensation and a lot of emotion as well. So even though I had all the fact checking, it still wasn't quite, you know, it wasn't the end of the story. I still had to learn later on how to discern, like, okay, what is, you know, physical hunger and fullness, and what's emotional hunger and fullness, and how all of that is actually in the body container, and learn how to discern the difference. And so that's something I had to learn later on. But like I said at the beginning, that was what put me on the right path. And yeah, that's something that a non-diet dietitian, they know what they're doing, can do really, really well to give people a lot of choice points.
And part of what made me think of you for discussing Principle 7 on coping with those feelings, and a lot of what you just described there, is you describe yourself as a somatic nutrition therapist, and it's not something I commonly see, and it's really intriguing to me. So for people who don't know what that term means, would you mind explaining that a little bit?
Absolutely. So somatic is, if you look it up, it's just the body. And what I did recognize is that in a certain amount of people that I see, you can, yeah, do the fact checking and do, you know, look at the cognitive dissonance around like what has actually happened is different from what I want to believe or have been led to believe is happening with food, body, whatever. And a lot of times what happens is that we can know some stuff in our mind, but it's not like seeping into our bones. Like, it feels like it's just not landing. And what I find with a certain percentage, and I think it's a pretty high percentage of people who struggle with food and body image concerns and you know, struggles, is that we get all the health at every size information and the attuned eating stuff and the mindful eating. And we see all the great people sharing their fat positive things on Instagram and giving us other visuals of like how an empowered person can look. And it's wonderful. And people can know all that, but it feels like I know it in my mind, but my body's just not there. And so I'd say in like the third-ish year of doing this work, and I was working with people and giving everybody all I got, and I would notice that there's a certain percentage of people that would really just struggle for it to land, and they really wanted it to, and it wasn't because of their lack of trying. And I started to look at like, what's happening in the session when maybe we're discussing food or body image, and I noticed people, certain topics would get really revved up or get a little shut down, and I'm like, something's happening, because they would come back and not remember everything that we worked on or talked about. And I'm like, something else is going on here. This is not a lack of willpower or desire to be free. And so I heard that, again, you know how some things come into your life and you go down these rabbit holes. So I started basically studying neurobiology and the impact of trauma because I started to see these, it wasn't a correlation. It was like, oh, my clients who are struggling more have reported a history of some kind of developmental trauma or shock trauma or some kind of abuse. And these same people, they either know about it or it's suspected or they know they have a memory. They're struggling more with like taking in these concepts and it landing and being livable. So I just started starting trauma. So this was in 2009. I just went down like not taking any more eating disorder training things, focus on the neurobiology of trauma. And so I just learned that if our bodies are basically offline and in threat response, like our flight or flight or freeze threat responses, we don't learn and we don't connect. We are just in this like, you know, the worst case scenario of like, how am I going to escape basically? And that will show up in the body, in the sessions with my clients, and it shows up in the food behaviors that like just seem to keep looping and looping. So anyway, since that time, I've just continued to take lots of trauma trainings and supervision to be able to help people find some sense of safety in the moment around food, which improves people's ability to have a dual awareness, like, okay, so what's actually real around food and body for me in 2020 versus what is body memory time? So that will feel different. It will feel old. It will like, it really feel like there's a danger right now. But again, I help clients see the incongruency of like, they're at a meal and they know they want to eat that meal or they want to be able to eat to a more comfortable fullness at a meal. And it feels like a struggle to like reach for and access what they need to do because the body is like on fire for like, it's not safe. And so Our job is to be able to slow things down, to orient towards safety, and then bring that experience to the body so the body can hear like, there's something here for me that I can reach for, that I can learn how to trust, versus being in like memory time, basically in the body. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing what you can see shift relatively quickly just by learning how, you know, some of these skills are just very practice-based oriented, but you have to create a space to grab it, to notice it, and then to keep practicing it. So it's more than just tuning in with hunger and fullness, because if you're in flight, let's say your digestion's offline, your blood flows in your periphery, your eyes, your heart rate to get you to run or to fight if you have to, you might not feel hungry when it probably would make sense for you to be hungry, but that's a little offline, for example. So I'm just really working to help people ground and orient towards safety if it's appropriate at whatever moment. Anyway, that's a little taste like what somatic work would look like. And I feel like if you're somebody listening that you've been truly struggling to like get to like a higher level of care and recovery and self-care, and it feels like you can't grab it and it's missing, or you've been trying to do intuitive eating for like 2 years and it's just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, you might be struggling with some stuff, dysregulation going on in your nervous system.
I think that's so important. And I think that's a missing link for a lot of people, because like you said, people can be doing all of the reading and collecting all the data and doing fact checking with a practitioner. But still, it's just like, for me, for example, completely out of the realm of eating, but I know I feel better when I get enough sleep at night. Does that mean I always go to bed at an appropriate time?
Right.
No. So it's kind of like other areas of our life too. Just because we have that information, it doesn't mean it's always going to come to fruition. And then also when you add into that extra layer of anxiety and you kind of get your body revved up in that fight or flight mode, having all that information isn't necessarily going to help us with our coping for that time being.
That's right. That's right. Because if you are in fight or flight, you may have a beautiful self-care list of what to do when you're anxious, but you actually have to regulate yourself I kind of have a three-step thing. It's like, so regulate, relate, and then we can problem solve. So it's hard to use your beautiful self-care list of like how to work through like a challenging food experiment, let's say, or how to like have the meal that you really, really want and not be scared of overeating it if you are feeling like you're in threat. It's just hard to access the things that you know would help you to do the thing you want to do with food. And so the first step is, do I need to go to a meal? Or not go to a meal, but do I need to bring what helps me feel more landed here and in here being okay? And so that might be simply that you need to get out, wash your hands, and just do a couple of things. Lay on the floor, use your weighted blanket before or during your meals to help bring a sense of like, it's almost like you can't be smelling the roses and running for your life at the same time. So if you're under a warm blanket, it's like your body has to make an assessment. Okay, it's warm and it feels snuggly in here. Can I orient to that? Is that enough to settle your system? Or maybe you need longer or more co-regulation from a person. That's possible too, before I can even eat the meal. That's a challenge for me. And so that's what the struggle is for a lot of people, is they know what they want to do, but just even getting there, that's probably like 80% of it. Getting to the table, feeling regulated enough to do it.
Yeah, I like that idea. And I'm not sure if that's a real life example of something that has worked for your clients, but kind of giving that moment of pause, whether it's laying down and feeling more grounded with, say, a weighted blanket or something along that line, so that you can actually come to the table or whatever task at hand that might be in a more calm mental state. I really like that example. And I think this whole conversation is really lending right into principle 7, as I mentioned, is cope with your feelings. And I definitely want to dive more into your three components with regulate, relate, and problem solve. But first, what do you kind of think of when you hear about principle 7, cope with your feelings without using food? What first comes to mind?
Well, what first pops to mind about that is it's like a both and. It's like we want to be able to honor the fact that eating is pleasurable. If we didn't have that wired in us, we probably wouldn't have a lot of motivation to get up when we're really hungry and do something about it, because we want to relieve that uncomfortable sensation. If you're really hungry, it's not going to leave you alone. And if there wasn't a pleasure aspect to eating, we wouldn't take care of that, right? Eating in itself, for like it being, has an emotion with it, that's not an issue. It's more about like, hey, if I don't have a toolbox or a plethora of ways to navigate and ride the waves of my emotion and not wrong them, but just see them as information, and if I have a history that there was nothing else here for me, then we might find that food becomes the only thing that we know. And that's the issue. And a lot of times people shame themselves for that. But I always remind clients is that, of course, you use food. Of course, you're restricted because there was nothing else there. So you got to start there first, is if you don't have thousands of co-regulatory experiences of being soothed, you will not be that adept as self-soothing without something to distract yourself. So we want to start there. And then it's like, of course you did that. And it's like working through like each eating experience, if it's feeling scary or out of control, is learning how to slow it down to assess like, what are the food needs and what are the other needs, and learning how to like best match everything, if that makes sense. And also recognizing that, yeah, sometimes we eat for fun, we eat for entertainment, we eat to feel calmer or even eat to ground ourselves. But if that's our only tool, that's where we kind of get led into a little bit smaller life, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's why I think nuance and discussing this principle is so important, because I think on first glance, and you just see the phrase cope with your feelings without using food, it makes it feel like it's never okay if you eat because you have different emotions or whatever the case may be. But in reality, you know, having cake at a birthday celebration, that's technically emotional eating, right? Where our emotion is celebration and happiness. And it's not always just cliche emotional eating when I'm sad or I get dumped or something like that. There's a lot of different reasons that can be, and none of them are inherently good or bad. It's just exactly like you said, it's if we don't have any other tools in our toolbox, that's when there can maybe be some problems that come along with it if we're not adequately addressing our emotions.
Right. And I think some of it, another like kind of baseline thing I would suggest, is a lot of times we just don't know how we feel. So you may have this vague sense of feeling blah or feeling like irritable and jumpy and I crawl out of my skin. And those are indicators of some kind of charge, whether it's emotion or maybe you can't really even name it. You don't name it as anxious, but maybe you name it as like, I always use funny words, but like chompy or buzzy. Those are associated with either some kind of belief or feeling and can easily get misinterpreted as hunger when maybe it is something more. And part of our work is to start to name even without the story at first. Just like, what is that? What is it like inside that you're noticing before you ate XYZ or before you didn't eat, when let's say you knew it's been a long time and kind of knew mentally probably need to be eating, but all you felt was XYZ. And so you didn't eat. sometimes even before we can label the emotions, we need to label the sensation and then work from there.
Yeah. Why do you think people have such a hard time putting a name to what the emotion is? Is it how we are raised in our childhood, or what do you notice?
Yeah, I noticed that for a lot of people, practically just things weren't beyond surface stuff, wasn't always either talked about or allowed or even safe to express. And so the expression comes eventually through the language of food and body. So instead of saying, you know, I feel disappointed, enraged, disgusted, and that was safe to do, you know, do something about or say, it gets translated into the language of food and body as like, you know, I feel fat, or I feel gross, or I feel bloated, or I'm crawling out of my skin and I must lose weight, or I've got to get fit, because that's a way to deal with what's in the container versus having practice, basically a practice of knowing how to express what is in the container. It just is coming out a different direction.
If someone comes to you and they're saying that they feel like they really are an emotional eater and out of control, and all of a sudden they've eaten an entire bag of potato chips or something like that, and they're dealing a lot with that and they feel out of control, what might be some, obviously there's more to the story than just that little example, but what would be some things that maybe you'd want to get to the bottom of?
Well, if somebody came to me and feel like, oh, Tracy, I just ate this bag of chips and I can't believe I did that, and what's wrong with me? Why can't I control myself? I'm such an emotional eater. The first thing I would say, like, yeah, that's hard. And that must be scary, huh? So right there, kind of eliciting the actual experience in real time versus getting too cognitive, and then see where that goes with that. But I would also want to look at the food tangibly, because a lot, probably 95% of times when people come to me and they have a incident like that with food, I have to make sure that you're eating enough, because 95% of the time there's some deprivation driven eating in there, like either literally, logistically not eating enough calories by the time you had those potato chips and other stuff was building up. And then here we are at the bottom of a bag of chips. And I would look at their food and say, oh, you know what? And I would go through the whole day, what they ate and what was going on around the food. And then like, you know, it totally makes sense you eat the whole bag of chips. Totally makes sense. And people often say, what? What do you mean? Yeah, you hardly had enough for breakfast. And your thoughts at breakfast were also, gosh, I ate this yesterday, so I should cut back today. So there's the deprivation right there. The physical, the mental, and emotional. And all along the day, there's this just a story of like not enough, not enough, not enough. Whether it's not enough food, satisfaction, validation, care. And so you're going to be, it's almost like we even build up resentment against the fact that we don't get our needs met all day. So of course, and if there's a lot of charge around, and if this is like old story too, if like I don't get my needs met, I don't get seen, what I want and need doesn't matter, my body's too much, I'm too much. I don't know about you, but that would make me feel probably a big old mix of possibly shame and anger and maybe fear. And if those emotions are coupled with a threat response, like maybe it was like threatening to feel this way, you're going to go into some kind of like fight or flight or freeze pattern, and you're going to eat to either not feel, you're going to eat to not feel all that. It's almost like this is a survival strategy now. Of course that happened, but you can back it up all day long and see, oh, this got really built up and got really big and scary, huh?
And I think it's really comforting too. And I feel like it would just be almost a sigh of relief if I were in session with you and had just admitted that I did this atrocity of eating this bag of chips. And of course, I'm saying that all a little sarcastically because it's not the worst thing you can do. But I can imagine if I was feeling that shame and you just now put a name to it and told me, like, I can imagine that's why you would have done that and you made it feel okay, like there's some sort of permission along with that, I would already feel myself opening up to you in session two and then open to more of those opportunities of understanding, like, oh, okay, maybe it's because I didn't eat enough during the day. Maybe it's because I was anxious because I have a big deadline coming up, and understanding and taking a bit of that pressure off yourself. Because I think the narrative so often in our diet culture is that it's all about discipline and our own responsibility. And I think a lot of times that makes us ashamed to even admit if we're struggling around food.
Right, exactly. And without knowing the neurobiology of like actually getting things done in the world, it's like you have to have a pretty big window of tolerance to like handle a lot of stressors and to not have some kind of like faux window to cope with it. I mean, it just happens because we live in such this fat phobic, thin obsessed, food obsessed, getting it wrong world. And food is for most people so accessible. It's almost like it's in a course. You know, people use restricting and binging to try get some relief. It's almost like, of course, we use that as some relief because it's so around us all the time that, and we haven't had enough of what we actually need, which is to know how to slow down, to know how to say no, and no mean a no, and a yes mean a yes, whether that means food or care or deadlines or time for ourselves or renegotiating something or something else, that it's like we are doing the best we can with what choices we've ever presented with. And, you know, my hope is that we can say, like, you know, your emotions aren't the worst thing that are trying to be expressed here. It's actually when they're not allowed to like exist is what causes all this suffering.
I want to circle back a little bit more because I find your knowledge on the neurobiology behind our emotions so intriguing. So I'm wondering if you could talk to me a little bit more about, you had mentioned the three main things that you look into are how to regulate, relate, and problem solve. I'm wondering if you can explain that a little bit more for me and for listeners.
Yeah, so it's just something that's pretty common in kind of the neurobiology world to kind of use a bottom-up approach, because when we're in a threat response, we're not using our more, for lack of a better word, evolved part of our brains where we can like emotionally connect with people and get the support we need and problem solve through things. We're really using the more primitive part of our brain that's really so awesome because it's like, I'm so glad that I can fight or flight or dissociate if I have to. Now, we don't want to have a habit of these things because that causes us to be so miserable and so exhausted, and it's not a thriving place to live in your lizard brain, like basically your amygdala. That's not a fun place to live because it's scary all the time. But we have these things because if we are in threat, we have a fighting chance. But the problem is that if we've had these like learned habituated habits of like seeing everything through, like, because usually of trauma or overwhelm, if we have, it's almost because like, you know, threat response becomes a habit. So everything that might cause a relationship rupture or being criticized or being uncertain, I mean, you know, uncertainty is really, really difficult for folks. This is why people cling so tightly to dieting, is because there's a certainty to it, right? Like, I know what's going to happen. If I eat this, this will happen. If I eat that, that's the result. So I guess it's just with the neurobiology around it, it's when we're not allowed, if we have basically thwarted attempts to get some relief in different times when we've been overwhelmed. So trauma only happens when we've had experiences that were just so overwhelming for our ability to cope and there was nothing there. So basically it's like this recapitulation constantly of too much and not enough, right? And how many times have you tried to like, when you think about recovery from eating disorder or chronic dieting, and it always feels like every time you try to do the thing that would be good for you, it feels like so much. At the moment, sometimes we don't feel like we have enough tools. And that's always the push and pull. And what takes the length that it takes sometimes to like fully feel at peace with food and weight is because there's this push and pull of like, I'm moving away from the safety that I thought dieting would bring me into some unknown that I don't really know what's going to happen, that makes me vulnerable. And so that's why, I hope I'm explaining this correctly, but it's like we only have the pace at which usually we can recover from chronic dieting and disorder eating is really dictated a lot about what our window of tolerance is. And window of tolerance is a term by trying to get my terms right here, but Dan Siegel, there you go, and Pat Ogden, they have lots of little infographics online if you look up their stuff, but they talk about like basically our window of tolerance is the amount of coping ability we have in our bodies and our systems. And we get that through our early experiences of like co-regulation in childhood. So basically the more times that you had, you know, like challenges and adversity, and when you're having those challenges, you had safety and you had connection and something basically having your back, the more we have of that, basically the more robust stress tolerance we have. Usually, and I put myself in this bucket too, I've had to earn a lot of secure attachment. I've had to really earn my ability to like have a big window of tolerance, is that those of us who have smaller ones see a lot of things that are frustrating or challenging or uncomfortable as threats versus like, well, that's a bummer and that's not ideal, but okay, I've got the tools to get through it. A lot of people just didn't have that base. So imagine you have your home and your concrete base of your home is based on really, really crumbly, smushy, not well set concrete. So you never know if the ground is solid underneath you, basically, to take a risk. So you just don't take a risk. And that's really scary. So you're probably going to create something called a faux window to help you feel like there's some certainty. And you could see how easily that could turn into eating things, right? Like if I get the right body, then I'll know that everybody likes me and I won't be criticized. Or if I don't eat the food in front of people because of what I look like, then at least I know that I won't be criticized for that food in public. You know, it's like always looking for the thing versus like having a big window inside saying, I'm at home with myself enough for the world, no matter what happens, that I've got a strong home base here inside myself. And that's what most of us are missing, you know, if we're struggling with food and weight concerns. So it's like our own, like you have your own inside personal small window, and then you've got our world that pretty much tries to force everybody into a small window by feeling like there's only room for a certain looking kind of person here. You know, so you've got like this double bind here of like, it's not safe inside and it's not safe out there. That's going to create a lot of emotion. Hence, you know, why it takes time to be able to actually separate food from emotion in terms of like, you know, and having the clarity and the nuance to know like, okay, this is not like a disordered thing I'm doing with my food. This is just normal people, quote unquote, emotional eating versus like panicking every time you just want to have a piece of cake for fun and feeling like you're not doing something wrong.
I can relate to a lot of what you're saying about how I think it lends into why a lot of people kind of lean on their perfectionistic tendencies. That kind of is what my journey with food was like when I was younger, is I was easily anxious. And so I think by controlling the amount of exercise that I was doing, and also by whether it was tracking calories or macros or whatever people are doing nowadays, it was almost like, okay, I won't feel anxious if I can control X, Y, and Z and live quote unquote perfectly within those means. But as you just mentioned, when the slightest inconvenience occurs, say I didn't get to have my perfectly planned out snack for the afternoon, it kind of derails you in a sense. And it certainly doesn't make you very flexible for the bigger world around us.
That's right. I mean, such a perfect, beautiful example of like, that's flight. So to have a relief valve for that flight, you're not supposed to live in like constant fight or flight. You're supposed to have like, nobody's ever going to be perfectly regulated. That's not the point. But you want to be at like some sense of like settled most of the time to be able to function and to thrive and like to do stuff, right? Without everything feeling like a threat. But if whatever's happening is beyond your ability, we will create, if our window's small for flight, let's say, and like uncertainty, we will create this secondary neural pathway system in our bodies to deal with that constant humming of a threat. And so our brains are, again, they're not trying to mess us up. They are just trying to give you a relief valve so you can not have a nervous breakdown, essentially. And so we create this faux window of like, okay, if I do these things, then I'm safe, versus let's create some real safety the best we can in the environment you're in. And no, there's no perfect safety. It doesn't exist, right? No matter how, and you probably know this too, man, no matter how perfect your food was or how small your body was, it's like there may be some people that just don't like your flavor of Kool-Aid, not because you do anything wrong. It's just it, right? And learning how to have capacity and resilience for that is what we want us, you know, we want our, like our children and all of us to learn as adults, even to like have a bigger window for adversity versus like, well, let me just put everything that I think is wrong with me over here and I'll focus over here and then I won't feel the fear. And it comes out through food rules and it comes out through compulsive exercise. You're so right.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And I think exactly. You know, like you said, some people you just aren't going to get along with. And I found myself also, I think, part of controlling those little parts of my life that I thought I could always control. Realistically, we know that diets typically don't work long term and aren't the greatest for us long term. But also, you know, it was kind of controlling that piece because I was very uncomfortable with, you know, does that person not like me? I was a people pleaser, wanted everyone to like me. And so it doesn't lend very well to good conflict management, which we know is pretty important in a lot of our job settings. And so it, again, just another reason that a lot of those control mechanisms don't work the greatest in other aspects of our life long term.
Absolutely. And again, those are strategies. They're defensive strategies. So they come into play when there's nothing else. There's nothing else. I mean, these strategies aren't like we don't decide usually. I mean, I've had exceptions where people come to me in their 40s or 50s and it was their first diet and it triggered an eating disorder, let's say. But when I look at their histories leading up to like that first diet or whatever, it's like they'd already had a lot, things were building. Like they'd had some like adversities happen and happen and happen and boom. So their window was getting really squeezed to where there's nowhere they could tolerate and they got a relief from those behaviors that were already happening. So there's always a pre-diet story or a pre-binging story that's like, oh, this is a relief valve. This is all this is. Okay, we got to get some relief here. And of course, me and almost always working with a really great, if I can, therapist, particularly eating disorder therapist, trauma therapist. Those are my preferences to have people get the direct trauma work and uncoupling work going. And then I get to like do a lot of regulation and safety building around the food, along with the cognitive stuff that we know that needs to happen around just the education of how food works, how bodies work, and working on those processes as well. So it all kind of goes together using the body, start from like I talked about with the bodies, like you regulate the body first and bring a lot of compassion to like, well, of course. So like there's a lot of fear running through there. Let's just be with that right now. And can you tell in your system, like right now, that I'm really here with you? Like I'm really here with you right now with what's going on. And I won't proceed until there's a sense of like, okay, like we're both landed here together. And then we go on, okay, so what are we doing next with you? Because beyond that, I can tell people what to do, but I know they'll come back next week, like, what was I supposed to do? Or I wasn't able to do it because I didn't have the bandwidth to do it. I didn't have the foundation to do it yet.
And I think it's important for practitioners to know that too, because I think, at least how I was feeling in school to become a dietitian, you always had to leave a session giving someone a nice, neatly put together handout. And so if you aren't giving them 10 self-care things to do before your next session, sometimes it can feel like you're not doing a lot. So I like that you're also giving dietitians, therapists that permission to find that landing place, and you don't have to have 10 solutions. And in fact, that can sometimes be more overwhelming.
Well, yeah, like think about again our capacity, like how much can we actually do? Sometimes the only homework is to I want you to, whatever tool they have to help them feel like something or someone is there for them as they're trying to eat. That's what they're doing. I didn't change their food that much because it's like we don't really need to change the food until we have access to feel more safe to eat the food. And then we can go on to the next step, whether that's like, getting a little bit more full at your lunch or it's maybe working on some gentle nutrition. It's like, let's get on board enough regulation to do that without feeling so overwhelmed. And then that will be more successful.
So when you find that more comfortable, grounded place, what might some of those strategies look like when you do start getting into more of that problem solving?
Well, problem solving is just like, what do you want? Like you have clarity about like what from a food perspective, like, what do you actually want? How do you get it? How do you make time in your week to make sure that you have more than enough if possible? What do you do? I always tell people my example, like when I buy groceries, I don't just buy like what I think I'm gonna need for 7 days. Like I always have some backup plans because I know me. I'll go to like, I'm gonna make that chicken on Tuesday. And it's like, Tuesday morning happens, like, yeah, that ain't happening. I'm not feeling it today. And so I'm so glad I've got the frozen ravioli in the freezer. Backup meals. Those are like very pragmatic, practical things. But man, we have to feel like we have capacity to do that before we can get there. Because I can have people buy tons of food and then they don't eat any of it because there's not enough like safety on board to make it. Or they'll look at all the food and it's like, well, what do I do now? And maybe they don't. It's not really appropriate for somebody to have a meal plan. I mean, there are people that probably reading this or listening to this, and it's like a meal plan is the absolute best thing they could do for themselves. That containment is so helpful. It cuts down some of the uncertainty. And for some people, that would just be the worst thing to do. They need a lot more autonomy and being able to just come to the little kitchen or the table 30 minutes before time to make something and they pick what looks best. Everybody's really different depending on their circumstances. But the planning is like before I can like, oh, and usually what happens, like usually the grocery store example, it's maybe a person's really trying hard to eat more food, but they just aren't eating anything. So I'll look at their food and it's like, well, first, you know, what's your experience like with going to the grocery store? And you can tell she see the panic of, I don't even know how to go there without leaving, without what I need. And so the whole session's about like finding some regulation and really working through the experience of that and how they can help slow it down to feel safer, to get the food, to get it into their house, and to actually do something with it. It's quite a cycle of like there's a lot of little actions to build safety around for that to be easy to do at some point for some people. And so when if you hear this and like, wow, I didn't know why I was struggling so much. And yeah, there's some parts of that process that feel really overwhelming. That's why it's not happening, not because you're not trying hard enough. And for some people, it's a non-issue. It's really more about just taking time to find their feet and their butt and their back in the seat. But when they start eating, just to help them locate, like, oh, I'm here right now doing this thing. I'm not 10 other places, you know, and I'm eating at a pace that I can tell how I'm doing and what I like. And sometimes it's just as simple as that.
And I really love this principle, especially because I think a lot of times intuitive eating gets watered down to just eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full, is kind of what it is perceived to be. But if you're going through these principles, say you're doing almost a self-study and trying to implement things together, and we kind of alluded to this earlier, you might get to a roadblock, if you will, and you're not really sure why things don't seem to be rolling in the right direction for you. And like you just talked about, it could be some of that regulation that you're not quite sure what to do with.
Even if it's written in all the books and you've heard it before, we need to hear this probably 1 million times, is that when you stop dieting or your binging is starting to ease up, you are going to feel more feelings, period. Because there is just so much dissociation and suppression and denial that denying our needs, whether for eating enough or stopping when we've hit our edges, that process does. You are moving and pushing around some things that feel uncomfortable. So when you're doing something different, you're going to, I call it like mobilize or liberate whatever was there. And so to just cut yourself a break, you're going to feel more feelings. I tell people by week three of eating more regularly, if not five or six, you are going to start to feel like, why am I doing this? This was a mistake. Like I'm feeling so much, and one day I'm ragey, and the next day I'm like sad and blah, and I feel all over the place. That's not for everybody, but for a lot of people, it's like, of course, you've invested 95% of your life energy doing these things. And so a lot of things have gotten swept under the rug. It's a lot of energy and a lot of focus to do what you've done with food to survive. So some things are going to come up. That's pretty normal. I just hope that people can give themselves a break around, like, you're not messed up. This is actually really normal. And we just need to have, like, I've been talking about this whole time together today, Amanda, is probably some regulation, some support to learn how to do that. And of course, the other tangible things, like people to talk to and other activities to do. And I'm not a big fan of like distract yourself, but sometimes we have to distract ourselves to like, okay, what do I actually really need here? Because this is all new territory. There's a lot of things that go into like the process of learning how to separate food and emotion without there being all this baggage of like emotional eating is bad.
Wow, I could talk about this for hours, I think. But one thing I wanted to ask you before I have you share some information about what you currently offer in your business, but for other dietitians, because I know I do have some dietitians and dietetic students who do listen in to the podcast, do you have any good sites or trainings that you personally recommend to learn more about this approach? Because I would say this is something that we definitely don't learn about, at least I didn't in my program, because we just learned a lot about the chemistry and biology behind food.
So I actually do have a, I mean, I don't want to plug myself, but I do have two training programs, one for non-diet counseling skills. And then I have a second program that is just all trauma and somatically integrated nutrition counseling skill based. So they're very different. One's like basically learn how to like, to be able to like ride the waves of people's strong emotion and stay on your side of, you know, as dietitians, we're not trying to be therapists, but there are things that we can do to help people and to help ourselves like stay more with our clients versus like change the subject, get too uncomfortable with the emotions, and just learning how to be a good nutrition counselor. The second one is really just all about the higher level work if you're working with a lot of complex trauma clients. So I recommend that. I mean, those programs, if you're interested in learning more, you can contact me. But especially from the trauma piece, I mean, I highly recommend people just start diving deep into like learning about polyvagal theory. That's one of the cornerstones of my work is helping people understand that like the ups and downs they might be having with their food have a base survival response. It's not just all like you're emotional eating all the time, you can't manage yourself. There's a reason, there's something in your system that's telling you there's a threat, and we need the food strategies to survive. And just helping people understand that that's not true, but that's what your body's saying because it's triggered right now. So anything you can learn about polyvagal theory, whether it's Deb Dana or, of course, The Body Keeps a Score. You could look at Peter Levine's work. I mean, there's so many amazing scientists that are studying this and making it as tangible as possible if you're a professional looking to do a little bit more of this work. So I have felt like it was a missing piece as a eating disorder nutrition therapist, many years ago, that I felt like, because I had a lot of really excellent eating disorder training, and even that wasn't enough for some people. Like, I really needed this missing piece of understanding the attachment and the threat response part. So
awesome. Well, I know that I will definitely be checking that out, and I'll be sure to link all of the information that you just mentioned in the show notes for listeners as well. As far as where can everyone find you, whether it's on social media, your website, all the places?
Yeah, so I have a website. It's tracybrownrd.com. And then for dietitians, it's embodieddietitian.com. And then on social media, I'm on Facebook. I love doing Facebook Lives and just talking about stuff like we're doing here today, all things somatically integrated nutrition counseling and movement and body image and food and all that. And that's at Tracy Brown RD on Facebook. And that's kind of it. And all my videos go to YouTube as well. So if you're not a Facebook person, it's on YouTube. So that's where I hang.
Thank you so much for coming on today and taking a little break from your chaotic schedule during the midst of this pandemic. I know it's crazy for all of us right now, but I really, really enjoyed this conversation today. That's our show for today. Thank you so much for tuning in, and thank you to Anchor for again hosting my podcast. Be sure to download and subscribe this podcast on Apple or your favorite streaming device. If you're looking for ways to get started on your own journey towards food freedom, head over to my website at spillingthebeansnutrition.com/course to get started on my self-paced course. If you need more individualized help, I also offer virtual coaching, and you can get in touch with me at spillingthebeansnutrition.com/virtual-coaching. To get show notes from this episode, you can go to spillingthebeansnutrition.com/podcast. And of course, if you're not already following me on Instagram or Facebook, I'm at spillingthebeans_nutrition. Our album art was photographed by my very own little cousin, Brittany Preller, and our theme song was written by Daniel James O'Connor and is used under the Creative Commons license.